Welcome to Be Nice or Leave. I'm your host, Polly Hammond. In a world where businesses are facing new challenges and heightened competition, empathy is becoming an increasingly important tool to better understand your customers, improve communication, and ultimately lead to increased profits. Through interviews with business leaders and experts, this series explores the ways in which empathy can help organizations overcome these challenges, to be better and to do better. Most importantly, we'll hear from the people who have made it happen and can see the positive impact it has had on their organization. So whether you're a business leader, an entrepreneur, or simply someone interested in the intersection of empathy and business, Be Nice or Leave is the podcast for you. Welcome to today's episode, Be Nice or Leave, where we explore the power of empathy in leadership and business. We're excited to have with us today a very special guest, Anne Devereaux Mills, author of The Parlay Effect, How Female Connection Can Change the World. Anne is a renowned speaker on women's leadership and the founder of Parlay House, an international community dedicated to fostering connections amongst women. Today, we'll be discussing the importance of self-empathy, the role empathy plays in building strong communities, how empathy can shape a thriving business culture, and the ways in which it contributes to business success. Anne brings a wealth of experience and insight to this conversation, and I'm thrilled to have you join us.
Thanks.
So without further ado, let's dive in. Welcome to the show, Anne.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
So many years ago, you made a decision to walk your path quite publicly and use personal trauma for collective good. Your writing, speaking, your philanthropic efforts, and of course you work with Parlay House, all focus on the need for connection to affect widespread change. So to start, I'd like to back up to the early days and ask about self-empathy. Was there a moment when you were going through health crises and personal challenges that you had to stop and say, I need to show myself some compassion?
That's such a good question, because I'm not sure I was aware that I was doing that at the time. Just to frame for the listeners what happened, I had been a single mom who had successfully extricated herself from an abusive first marriage. And I never thought, as a feminist and advocate for women, that I would be in an emergency room getting counseling about domestic violence. But there I was. And after an 18-year marriage, I finally got myself into a much better place, only to be diagnosed with cancer for the first time during that divorce. And then when my daughters and I sort of got our footing as a unit of three, I found out that the cancer had returned. It was 2009 during a very tough economic time. And I was running a turnaround company, which is really not my core strength. I'm a much better entrepreneur and builder than I am a downsizer and right-sizer and firer of people. And so, you know, I have developed grit because my life path was not easy. And so when I walked up Madison Avenue in my 4-inch heels to go to my boss and say, hey, I need to take a couple weeks off to have this surgery, I expected him to say, of course, you know, you've done this before and, you know, you've worked for me for 25 years and we're with you. But he said, no, I think I'll have someone else run the company. And in that moment, I lost my job. I had just been told that my health was at risk. The way that I defined myself was being at the gym before I got to the office, which was at 7:30 in the morning. So we would be there at 5:15 in the shivering cold, waiting for someone at Equinox to open the doors. And all those things, including being a mother, because my youngest of two daughters was about ready to leave for college, were thrown out the window all at once. And I went from thinking I had fought through it in the most tough way to feeling like, it had fought through me. And I was really left with a complete sense of emptiness. And I guess a sense of not knowing who I was, because without the description of I'm a CEO or I'm a mom or I'm an athlete, I had no idea. And so did I show myself empathy at that time? I'm not so sure. I felt badly. I felt scared. I felt alone, But I think the kindness came after some deep introspection about what I needed. And some of it probably was self-empathy, and I am not so good at giving that because, I don't know, I'm hard on myself, I guess.
Most of us are.
Yeah, yeah. But I think over time, my understanding that I probably wasn't as alone as I felt I was, and I needed other people to talk about their truths in order to make me feel less alone in mine. I mean, that's how my organization, Parlay House, was founded, because I needed that empathy to come from somewhere else in the beginning.
Right. I think it's interesting that you mentioned domestic violence and the history, because my last interview, some very good friends of mine, and that was exactly where we ended up. And the conversation was that often that like wellspring of an empathetic response comes from people who've come from traumatic childhoods, from difficult coping mechanism. And it almost, and I don't think you can see it when it's happening, you know, it's that silver lining to the really terrible cloud, is that you are just able to give so much more of your care and your interest and your empathy to others. So it's super interesting that you mention identity, because this is something that comes up whenever I talk to women about the subject of this podcast. Their feedback implies that their understanding of empathy is equal to sacrifice. If I can take an empathetic approach to another person, then am I not obligated to tamp down my own needs in order to meet what that other person wants? So in the course of all your own work, your personal work, your professional work, and the community, what do you see as that dynamic between empathy and self-advocacy?
Another awesome question. And I think about this a lot. I don't know if you do an Enneagram or anything like that, but I am clearly a number two. And a number two means somebody who is very compassionate and caring about other people, oftentimes to the point of self-sacrifice. And I see myself doing it in life all the time. And so, you know, this is my path to practice walking down is empathy for self. And yeah, I think I was raised to tough it out. You know, I came from a loving family, but definitely sort of old Midwestern stock of, you know, get back on that horse and keep going. And
100%.
And I remember when I was at Memorial Sloan Kettering, waiting for my turn to be called in to see the oncologist, I would play all sorts of games with myself that the other mental games to get through it, I think, that all these other people who are waiting are much sicker than I am. And I would transfer my grief to them rather than to myself. So yeah, good lesson I'm still working on.
I mean, I think we all are. If there was a good answer to this, I wouldn't be asking the question. What I notice is that the path to becoming more empathetic can be quite confronting, because it makes us, just as you say, look at our own assumptions about ourselves, our own, going back to coping mechanisms, just all those habits that we have. Have you seen through your work with other women that there are patterns of challenges around empathy and identity, empathy and leadership? You know, do we kind of fall into common personas?
Yes, I think we're in somewhat of a transformative time from a leadership standpoint. I mean, I know that when I was running companies and then would come across employees maybe 10 years later who, you know, I was running the company when they were young and in the workforce, they would say to me, you know, the empathy you showed us or the decisions you made to balance work and life, you know, parenting and success or whatever those balances are, modeled for me in my younger life, this is someone else speaking, how to behave when I became a leader, when I moved through the world. And so I think some of that was subconscious, but I was always you know, empathetic to other people and kind to other people. And now, while I think there still is a pretty tough, tough situation for a lot of managers who can't figure out how to be both strong and empathetic, I think that there is more empathy allowed, more room for kindness and empathy than there was when I was coming up in the work world. It was always felt, I remember being coached by HR people, if we had to do some sort of staff reduction, I was literally coached that legally I should not show remorse. I should not show sadness. I should not show that I felt badly. And, you know, many times when you're running a not huge company, you know, not only the people that you're letting go, but their families and the impact on them. And, you know, so in retrospect, I don't believe HR departments are so driven by legal that they lose all kindness anymore. And that's a step forward, but it's not a very, you know, not a very big step. Like, duh, we should be understanding of the human implication of a business decision.
So it's funny, nobody will believe that we didn't work together on the questions, because one of my follow-up questions is, how can this level of empathy, whether it's self-empathy, learned empathy, help leaders overcome that pressure to always put on the strong facade? I'm going to relate it back to a parenting story. I've got two grown girls now, but when they were little, I had this counselor at their school say to us, and we were expats, we were completely alone in a foreign country. I had no family. And she said, oh, you must never let your children know that you doubt your approach or you doubt yourself. And I was like, that's ass. Like, of course, because one of these days they're going to be me parenting a child or dealing with an employee or a partner or whatever.
Yep.
And fear is a normal part of our response, decision-making, you know, learning, growth.
100%.
So how do we balance that?
You know, it's funny that you say that because, you know, I have two grown daughters as well, and that's probably a whole other podcast is parenting adult daughters. But I remember when I've been asked, you know, over and over, what mistakes did you make that if you could live your life over, you thought you would change? And I did not, you know, I was literally wanting to make sure that I stayed alive till my girls were independent, because I was the sole parent and the only safe place, and my health was at risk multiple times. And I never showed them that I was scared. I never showed them that I felt like I failed at work. I never showed them that I didn't know how to pay the bills, you know, that the bills were catching up faster than I could cover them, or whatever the decision was. And so when they would go to college or be, you know, young adults right into the work world, and all of a sudden things felt incredibly hard, you know, they didn't feel like they were performing well at work. I've been there a million times. They didn't feel their boss was kind to them. I've been there a million times. They didn't know what to do about the person they were dating. They were imperfect. I've been there a million times. I never talked about any of those things. And what I so wish I could rewrite that chapter, because they often, I don't think they'd think I'm perfect anymore, but I think I set this expectation that life is easy and, you know, it's easy to succeed and we don't have worries and we don't have self-doubt. And I messed that up.
Do you think that that's one of those lessons of parenting that we need to roll over into all the other parts of our life, our friends, our employees, our partners, 100%. You know?
100%. And that's really what happened when I started Parlay House. Is I invited 12 strangers into my living room because I didn't know one single person in San Francisco when I moved there after this, you know, horrible life inflection point. And I literally wanted to talk about my weakness and my despair and my feelings of failure and my feelings of betrayal and all the things that had happened to me. And when I opened up to 12 strangers about how I was feeling, they all said, and this was 11 years ago, so it was before the Me Too movement had started and before all of these other, you know, sad ways we women are bonding with each other. But I would say, I feel like an imposter. And they would say, me too. And I said, I feel like a failure. And they would say, me too. And when I took the lead in saying, boy, I messed that up, you could see the exhale that everyone felt like, oh, they could be imperfect and have this self-doubt, and they weren't alone in feeling that way. So not that I want to bring everybody to the lowest common denominator of feelings that we all feel kind of shitty, but it was validating. And it's funny now that's a huge, we have many, many, many parlay houses around the world, but San Francisco is where it began. And I bought a painting of Frida Kahlo that's actually made up of letters. So it's, if you imagine, it's pixelated. And when you look up close in each of the letters, it's her famous writing that says, I used to think I was the only strange woman in the world. And then I realized there's a big world out there, and somewhere there's someone, and she's strange just like me. And that makes me feel less alone. And I think the minute we open up our vulnerabilities and our regrets and our, you know, maybe equally importantly, our aspirations and needs and goals and, you know, some of the positive things, we not only feel connected, but we lift each other and we can support each other because we see each other so much more deeply.
One of the things that we talk about with empathy that I see mirrored on the Parlay House site is this notion of safe spaces.
Yep.
And that's really what we're talking about, are safe spaces. It seems like there are a lot of spaces that purport themselves to be safe and aren't.
Yep.
And one of the things that I noticed about Parlay House is that you have very specific language that says, don't come, this is not for you to come pitch your business.
Yes.
This is not what this space is about.
It's not networking. It's not extraction. It's not transaction. It's not, maybe most importantly, and I actually think we should add some language about this, it's not about judgment. I think we grow up in such a judgmental world. And the minute you take that away and say, except, whether you agree or disagree, whether your experience was the same or not the same, don't judge the other person's truth. Try to walk in their shoes and imagine how different your life or your experience might be if you could see it that way. And, you know, it's a hard thing to do because I think we grow up in a world, especially these days on social media, you know, the distance from the human that you're commenting about allows people to be so much more cruel than if they had to say something to the face of someone that they're talking about. But at Parlay House, we are looking into the face of the person we're talking to, and being free from judgment, even if their view on abortion is the opposite of yours, or, you know, something that's sort of one of those hit you in the heart issues with that really could divide people, politics. You know, there is so much to learn from, love, respect, understand about the people who are most different than us, that I think if we were able to do that without judgment, we would see that we're not as far apart as we think we are.
So that really touches on one of the things I'd love to hear more about your experience. Right now, it can be really scary to communicate. I think there are a lot of us generationally, culturally, who are trying to do better and trying to learn, but still get things wrong out of ignorance and habit and not overt desire to give offense. How can the community spaces, how can a place like Parlay House or any, because not everyone's going to have a Parlay House around the corner. How can we open ourselves up to the non-judgment on both sides? So you're not trying to offend. I'm not going to hear offense. And together we're going to work on a better collective language or approach or understanding.
I think the experience of listening is highly underrated. All of us want so badly to get our point across that we fail to really listen to each other. And so my personal approach is when someone else who has very different view of the world is speaking, I shut up for a little while and just try to take in what they're saying. And very often their sources of information and formation. So formation, what religion did they grow up in? What city did they grow up in? What political point of view did they grow up in? And layer that with what are their sources of information now, which despite the fact that we live in this highly communicative world, you can have two completely opposite experiences depending on what your sources of news are and what your school is teaching you and what your neighborhood values are. And so I have people who I love very, very much who I do not agree with their, you know, fear of immigrants or, you know, whatever has framed their different view of the world. But by not talking and just listening to the things that they highlight or what makes them feel the way they do, I understand it a little bit more. And sometimes engaging in healthy debate is a good thing. And sometimes loving despite disagreements is a better thing.
I think we can all maybe work on that. I know that I can. I actually know that the people who are closest to me are the ones that are hardest to jump through that because I'm so emotionally attached to their worldview, you know, and knowing that in some sense, in a different parallel world, that could have been my worldview. And that's also, I think, jarring. So taking this from the personal and the community into the professional space, just going to ask the question, does it apply? Does empathy apply in a space where the goal is to make money for a shareholder?
You know, one word, yes. But it translates differently, of course. You can make money and be kind. You can understand the impact of the heavy pressure for profit on the humans that it affects. And you can understand that there's a point when pushing people towards that highest numeric goal takes a longer term toll on retention of employees, on loyalty, on job satisfaction, that you get diminishing returns if you push too hard for profit. And so I think there's a line. You know, you can't succeed when you have everybody that is in a free-for-all of criticism and unhappiness all the time. And you can't succeed if everyone is just burnt out and you're putting people in this hamster wheel of productivity without understanding the human element. I think COVID did us a little bit of a favor in allowing some alternative ways to drive profit that includes people working from home or different formations of teams or alternative ways to communicate instead of being stuck in meetings from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. every day that take a toll on our humanity. So yes, I think there is absolutely essential space for empathy in the workforce.
So how can a leader move beyond what I would consider as performative and almost like entertainment, you know, the ping pong tables and the popcorn on Friday.
I think that's all garbage. Yeah.
It's all bullshit, right?
Yeah.
Into actually, especially if it's someone who they're not deeply introspective, they've got no spiritual foundation for it. Like, what does it take for an organization to make the leap?
Well, I think looking for the ways that people truly feel like part of a community. You know, work is another form of community. In fact, most of us spend more time in our work communities than we do in our actual communities. And so, you know, I can't judge how good a ping pong table is. You know, I think really the ping pong table is an acknowledgement of there needing to be time to be removed, you know, to take a step away from the intense work. Or I do my best thinking when I'm doing something creative, not just trying to plug away. So, you know, polling your staff and seeing what's meaningful for them, you know, is it a free yoga session before, or is it, you know, the snack stocked in the fridge, or what is it? It depends a lot on the group. You know, if you work for a tech company, that tends to be people who would go home and play video games. They're not tired of their computers, but there's, you know, there's a different form of release for them than there might be if you were in a, I don't even know, you know, different environment with a different type of
manufacturing.
Manufacturing. Yeah. Yeah. What feels good for them. So, you know, I think a lot of it is the give and take of employees being heard and what they want being incorporated into whatever those perks are that help make the workplace feel a little more welcoming. I'm not anti-ping pong. Let's not.
I love popcorn.
You love popcorn?
Popcorn on Fridays.
Yeah.
One of the things that I noticed, though, and this is kind of in all work, I'm sure you saw this as well. A lot of people or a lot of companies, they want the roadmap. Like, they don't want the sort of esoteric, well, we have to dig into them. But they're like, really, okay, what's step 1, 2, 3? What are the kind of questions that people are coming to you, women at Parlay House, who are leadership in trying to drive this change? What are they asking you? And if you can share anonymously, maybe some great stories or what some of the feedback or examples of what that change looks like.
You know, this is going to sound really terrible, but I think we're in this time where it's really hard for leaders to continue to lead strongly because, and this is a different generation of employees that are pushing back so hard. You know, that for I'm at the tail end of baby boomer, so I'm like the last year I think that I could technically be called a baby boomer. But our baby boomers were all about work and productivity and how much have you done, and you know, we moved as far away from our families as we possibly could, and you know, we were just we threw away everything for the possibility of success. And when I look at my daughter's generation, they balk at not working hard because I think they do work hard, but life balance would be their priority and not success or profitability or monetary gain for the most part. And I'm sure there are plenty of people who are still as driven as I was back then. But, you know, I look at my kids' values and, you know, I never knew my grandparents, and yet I'm a grandmother now of a 17-month-old, and I would spend every moment I could bonding with her because, you know, my kids have reminded me of those values. And I think the hard thing for a leader is now that there's such a strong push for balance is how we don't overbalance and underdeliver from a business standpoint. And to not be perceived as an asshole boss because you're still trying to be profitable and successful and achieve growth and hit your numbers and all those things. It's a very fine line. And so I think this is true, my management style in general, is the more you can make people feel part of the solution in finding that balance and not bow, you know, many of us now bow to the more junior, the more young staff who are saying, these are our new values. We're at a very tough time because there is so much upward criticism of leadership, you know, a little bit of a lagging response to how bad leadership can be or used to be, or maybe sometimes still is in abusive, profit-only driven organizations. So I think we're all doing a very fine dance of trying to figure out what the new normal, the new balance is.
Yeah, that pendulum is still swinging.
It's swinging. Yep. I mean, I think it always swings. This is just the nature of people and politics and countries, that everything swings to the right and to the left, and hopefully doesn't swing so far that you isolate or alienate the end where the pendulum is not.
And also going back to self-empathy, I think giving everyone grace, we're all going to screw up.
Yep.
We're all going to screw up at something.
Yep.
Even our leaders, even So then one of the things that I think as we move from internal workspaces, safe spaces, communication, that you have a background in advertising.
Yep.
And communication. And, you know, empathy has always been the purview of sales. You know, like a good salesman was naturally empathetic. How are businesses able to, seeing businesses employ empathy in what is the positive, you know, in a good way, but in a good way that builds better products, better communication, better comms?
I'll tell you a story. You know, a lot of my expertise is in the healthcare field, and we were launching a drug for high cholesterol and trying to figure out what the experience of someone with being diagnosed with something was. And what we found was the doctors, you'd go in and you'd be, you know, slightly overweight, not in great shape. And the doctors would say, your cholesterol is high. You've got to diet and exercise and come back to me in 3 months. And if your numbers aren't better, I'll put you on medication. And inevitably, people would come back and the doctor would say, yep, you're a failure. It didn't work. And here's your, they wouldn't say you're a failure, but that's what they're saying is, no, you didn't, you couldn't do it. So here's your penalty.
I passed your drug.
So we're wondering why people have lifelong issues that could cause, you know, heart attack, stroke, et cetera, that they're not dealing with. It's because taking a pill every day became a reminder that they were failing at something that they were told to do, and that our society says you should be able to diet and exercise. So when we understood that when the doctor says that, only 10% of people are actually able to get their cholesterol down to a level that's manageable without the intervention of medication, we came up with the insight that we had to offer them absolution. You know, it's not your fault. This is genetic, and most of it is genetic. And so by saying, we are so sorry that you got handed this, you know, this tough bill of goods, but here's actually something that will help you live the long, healthy life that you're already trying to live. And the minute we offered them that forgiveness, that non-judgment, that understanding, instead of the penalty for failure, we had dramatically better compliance on taking the drug. People felt better about it. They took it for longer. And so, you know, in the advertising world, we're not, oftentimes it's what is someone drawn to? You know, who's the sexy voice of the brand, or who's, that's not real emotional insight. But emotional insights like, yes, you are not a failure for living your life as best as you can, and we're just here to help you make sure that all the good work you're doing isn't gone to waste. That's meaningful. That's a meaningful, empathetic communication solution that isn't based on, well, if Brittany likes it, I like it. Or Miley or Dolly or, you know, whoever your hero is.
Your hero is.
Yeah. Right.
Anne, it's been a delight.
So fun. So fun. I'm glad we ended
Tell
with,
me what's
with knitting.
Tell me what's on for Parlay House.
Oh, my God.
Because I signed up when I was researching.
Oh, great. We just have, on an ongoing basis, so many fabulous conversations, whether it's Shabana Basij Rashid, who was a young woman going to school under the Taliban, the last time the Taliban were in power, and girls were not allowed to go to school, but her parents believed in girls' education. So her sister, who was of the age where she had to wear a burqa, was not allowed to walk on the streets without a male escort. So they took little Shabana, cut off her hair, dressed her as a boy, she was seven, and she escorted her sister, what seemed to be like going to the market, but was actually to underground school so that they could get an education. She then went to, when the Taliban lost power, she went to Middlebury, came back to Afghanistan, started the first school for girls in Afghanistan, and then recently when the Taliban came back into power, had to get every single one of those 260 students safely out of the country and to another place to continue their education, since, of course, that's been taken away from girls. So that's the kind of, we would have that conversation. We would talk to Deirdre Wolownik, whose son is the famous free solo climber, Alec Hammond, who, I don't know if you've seen the movie Free Solo, but he does these unbelievable climbs up mountain faces. And Deirdre at 60 years old, realized she didn't have much time with her son because he was always hanging off a mountain and she was living a sedate life. So she started learning to run. She couldn't run a mile at the beginning. And now at 71, she's completed, I think, her seventh climb of El Capitan at 71 years old. So she'll talk about her story. You know, we have women who talk about how to be the financial boss of your life. Many of us are in a transition, moving to a new city, starting a new job, being in a new life stage, divorced, married, whatever, whatever. But we need coaching on how to take over responsibilities that are more practical that we've never been in charge of before. So whether it's inspirational, insightful, empowering, we rotate the content to make sure that we're bringing people stories they've never heard and things that are helpful and lift them and make them feel more connected in the world. So that's in person, that's online, that's through our own podcast called Bring a Friend. And I love that you signed up. I hope we'll have you with us many, many times.
So now tell all my listeners how they sign up too.
Just go to parlayhouse.com, P-A-R-L-A-Y. And I named it Parlay House because I was at a stage where I was parlaying one stage of my life into another. You know, we talked at the beginning about that emptiness without a job, without health, without a kid at home. And I needed to parlay it into something different, which I did. Parlay also, spelled differently, means to speak in French. And when I went to buy the website, I found out that a parlay is a gambling term and it means the stakes are higher when you're in it together with consecutive bets. And so I thought, wow, this was really meant to be because the stakes are so high for all of us. And you feel much more likely to succeed when you're part of a safe, belonging community that welcomes everybody for conversations that matter.
That's wonderful.
Thank you.
It's been such a great session. I look forward to meeting you in person.
Me too. I can't wait.
We've covered a lot of ground today. Thank you, Anne.
Thank you.
And that's a wrap. A great big thank you to my guest, Anne Devereaux Mills, for joining me today. And thank you for listening in.
If you're interested in learning more about how empathy can transform your business for good, make sure to hit that subscribe button. And if you have any questions or feedback, I'd love to hear from you. You can reach me online at fiveforest.com or on social media at fiveforest. I'll add the links to the description. See you next time.